Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, although it's just little of me today, Amy's off, remembering the great Tina Turner this morning with some of her best offerings. Simply the Best is one of my favorite Tina Turner songs. Feel free to offer your own. We'll have a smattering of Tina Turner songs all morning. But, of course, the big news yesterday was one of the big news stories yesterday. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida formally entering the race in that Twitter Spaces conversation interview he did with Elon Musk. Here is the ad that was part of DeSantis's rollout yesterday.
Our border is a disaster. Crime infests our cities. The federal government makes it harder for families to make ends meet. And the president flounders. But decline is a choice. Success is attainable, and freedom is worth fighting for. Righting the ship requires restoring sanity to our society, normalcy to our communities, and integrity to our institutions. Truth must be our foundation, and common sense can no longer be an uncommon virtue. In Florida, we proved that it can be done. We chose facts over fear, education over indoctrination, law and order over rioting and disorder. We held the line when freedom hung in the balance. We showed that we can and must revitalize America. We need the courage to lead and the strength to win. I'm Ron DeSantis, and I'm running for president to lead our great American comeback.
Turnkey.pro answer line 646-36-DA turnkey.pro text line. Did you tune in to DeSantis's rollout? 700,000 people plus did. It created some problems with Twitter servers and some audio difficulties in terms of listening to the Q&A between Musk and DeSantis. And this is something that Trump seized on as characterizing it as a failure to launch, essentially. Terrible movie, by the way. Did you watch? Did you listen? Are you excited about DeSantis finally entering the race? Of course, his entrance did not receive the same warm welcome that Tim Scott's did by one former president. Trump tweeting out, "Rob," I guess that's Ron DeSantis, "Rob, my red button is bigger, better, stronger, and is working. Yours does not, per my conversation with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, soon to become my friend." I'm sort of befuddled by that comment. I don't really know. There's been some offers of translating what Trump said. Rob is DeSantis. So Rob is another nickname for DeSantis. Have I missed something on going back and forth on social media in terms of Trump moving from de-sanctimonious to Rob? Okay. My red button is Truth Social. Yours is Twitter and the botched launch. I guess that's what he means. That's the best translation I've read about that tweet. Sometimes Trump's tweets are a bit inscrutable. I don't know. you're supposed to know sort of these nuances of his thinking. I don't know. But the formal response, the formal response from President Trump came in the form of an ad they had ready to go for Ron DeSantis' announcement. And he took the track of disloyalty, which is not inconsistent with the track that he's been taking publicly.
Ron DeSantis was struggling big time in his primary race for governor of Florida. Polls revealed DeSantis was failing so bad, he was losing by a staggering 17 points. Then DeSantis was saved by the endorsement of President Trump. Trump's support was so powerful, just days after the endorsement, DeSantis took a commanding lead that propelled him to being elected governor.
I'd like to thank our president for standing by me when it wasn't necessarily the smart thing to do.
You're welcome, Ron. Unfortunately, instead of being grateful, DeSantis is now attacking the very man who saved his career. Isn't it time DeSantis remembers how he got to where he is?
Make America great again. Build the wall. Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
Truth is, there's only one person who can make America great again.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
Yeah. What do you think of that approach on DeSantis? He was disloyal. And there's no question, it's just, you know, facts and evidence, that Trump endorsed DeSantis in 2018, and it helped propel, it helped. It's more complicated than just Trump's endorsement. Helped propel DeSantis past Adam Putnam, the Ag State's Ag Commissioner, in the primary, and then on to victory over Gillum in the general, narrow victory. But is it disloyal to be thankful for an endorsement from 5 years ago, but to say, I think I'm better positioned and would do a better job based on the experience I've had and what I've demonstrated to the country as governor of Florida than you would, Mr. President? Is that disloyalty in politics? And even more to the point, do you think that sort of approach comes across as a bit petulant and largely irrelevant? Is it really some sort of character indictment of Ron DeSantis? Or is it a character indictment of Donald Trump? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. You think people care about, you endorsed him, and so you're not allowed to run until he says it's okay to run, and if he's running, you can't run against him. Is that how it works? Bill and Glenn Allen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I hope people are ready, because the mainstream press is all in for Trump being the nominee because they think they can beat him. But the problem is, well, they're going to make Trump out to be a good guy now, and DeSantis is the fascist, which we all expected anyway. But the thing is, Ron DeSantis is not going to be easy for Trump to deal with. He's not Marco Rubio. He's not Jeb Bush. He's competent. He knows what he's doing. And you can see already that Trump is having a hard time just dealing with it. I mean, he was able to dismiss Marco Rubio and Jeb fairly easily. That's not going to happen with Ron DeSantis. It's a whole different can of worms. So this is going to be really entertaining until the election day. Hopefully, President DeSantis will come out on top.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Well, you're right. He's not going to be able to dismiss DeSantis. Of course, the advantage he ultimately had didn't seem like an advantage maybe at the outset, but the advantage he ultimately had in 2016 was he was one of a dozen candidates, not one of a half a dozen. The disadvantage that DeSantis has is that he's not the only guy in the race, and he's not the only guy in the race with money and the possibility of running a credible campaign for, you know, the relatively long haul, and I'm talking about Tim Scott. Most notably, we'll see. The other thing that you hear these rumblings, and I think I'm not sure that they're real, but I think there's something you have to watch, that if DeSantis doesn't perform well out of the gate, that's an if. I'm not placing much stock in some technical difficulties because of overloading Twitter servers last night. But if he doesn't perform well out of the gate, then you have this sort of noise on the periphery Well, then maybe we need to get Glenn Youngkin in the race, the governor of Virginia. And maybe you have Glenn Youngkin sitting on the sidelines watching this play out a little bit, see how DeSantis does. And if he falters at all, then, and you have donors say, I don't know if DeSantis is up for the job. It doesn't look like he can beat Trump. And they migrate over to Youngkin. Then maybe you have Youngkin in the race. And if he gets in the race late, that really complicates things because he doesn't have near the national profile that DeSantis does. Though I think he's done a pretty good job as governor of Virginia so far, he doesn't have the record that Ron DeSantis does either. So it becomes real complicated if DeSantis doesn't perform well out of the chute. Tony, Downers Grove.
I agree with everything the caller said prior. If anybody watched the interview he did with Trey Gowdy, mm-hmm. you'd be pleasantly surprised. And I'm sorry, I voted for Trump twice, but he just can't stop acting like a petulant child. And I'm not sure what getting out of the gate fast means exactly. I mean, you do, but I don't. He just has to perform and hold himself as he did yesterday, and I think he'll be fine. And I don't believe what the mainstream media puts out there. I don't even believe what part of the Republican backers put out there, because their incompetence continues to show. So we'll see what happens. I don't know about Tim Scott. I know the field is crowded right now, or it seems to be at this point. And it'll take away from DeSantis maybe a little. We'll see. But the more coverage he gets, the stronger he's going to get. And I believe that.
Thanks for the call, Tony. I'm certainly inclined to think that as well, because I think DeSantis is a smart and talented guy. The only thing I'd say in terms of getting out of the gate, strongly, what that means. The only thing I want to see is Ron DeSantis going to be at the national level, the candidate and the governor he has been at the local level in Florida. We talked about this a bit before. In other words, all the people around him now, including some establishment figures of the Bush Rove ilk, does DeSantis try to round off the edges? Does DeSantis try to be more vanilla? Is he going to speak with less clarity on some of the cultural issues? If he starts to become vanillaized by the consultants, then I worry for his candidacy. So that's sort of what I don't. He's not particularly gaffe prone. He's too shrewd. He's too detail oriented for that. How he reacts to Trump, is he willing to confront Trump directly on the substance and stick there? And is he willing to resist the siren song of consultants to be a standard issue Republican? Those to me are some of the metrics I'm looking to apply to DeSantis's candidacy in the coming weeks. But, I think there's every reason to be optimistic about how he'll perform, as Tony said. Sean on the Northwest side.
Hey, the relationship between the both of them can't be a political relationship. It needs to be about bros before hoes. I don't want my guy dating my ex that ruined my life until I get my revenge first. And then he's got to ask my permission, and I got to give him the hot hand up, Just wanted to say that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Sean. Thanks for breaking it down. For us. Mike, Northwest Indiana.
This does just apply to DeSantis, but politicians in general. Dan, if you had a staff member on your staff and he came to you and said, Dan, I'm going to take a year off. I expect full pay and benefits in the meantime while I'm gone, while I search for a better job. And if I don't get it, I want my old job back. What would you tell him?
Yeah, I hear that. Thanks for the call, Mike. I mean, that is it's not an advantage of incumbency for Ron DeSantis because of Trump's standing. He doesn't need to have an office or even the previous one, although the office of the presidency even posthumously provides a lot of advantages too. But the idea of candidates running for office while in another office definitely is a sort of a structural problem with our politics that provides undue advantage to incumbents. So I hear that, but DeSantis is playing by the rules of the game that are present. And so, you know, I don't know. I think it's difficult to fault him for doing so.
Listen to the podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Now, from the Signature Bank studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy is off today, so it's just me. The state budget yesterday, the Democrat Socialist leadership of the state of Illinois, that would be Governor Spaulding and Senate President Don Harmon and Speaker of the House Chris Welch. Great job, West Central Cook County, with Don Harmon and Chris Welch doing a great job, Brownie. Little reference to the George W. Bush era, you remember, to apply that to Harmon and Welch. And then, of course, great job, Illinois, with rewarding Governor Pritzker with the second term. He's rewarding his constituencies, not constituents, constituencies, with $50 billion in spend, including billions on aid, health care for persons in this country illegally. Announced a budget deal yesterday, saying this.
This is not just a balanced budget. It's a good budget that funds the things that are priorities for my administration that were in the original introduced budget and includes things that the House and Senate wanted to increase or add to it.
So the House and Senate came together and decided we'll spend even more than Pritzker proposed. Wonderful. Sure. Nice game of one-upsmanship there. Not included in the budget deal announced by the two legislative leaders and the governor yesterday is the tax credit scholarship program in Illinois, Invest in Kids, which in its 5 years of existence has raised more than $330 million in private donations and provided scholarships to some 40,000 kids over that time. There's currently 9,000 children whose futures hang in the balance because they're on scholarship, and parents need to know, am I going to be able to still send my child to this private school that I'm able to send him or her to because of the scholarship? I need to know that, because if the money is going to get pulled, then I may need to change where my kid goes to school, right? So despite what was announced yesterday and what I've been saying before, that this thing is DOA, and what I said yesterday, that this thing is now dead officially, there is still a flicker of hope. There's still a flicker of hope that this can be included. And it, by the way, and it has to be included now. If they play this Springfield game where they say, well, it's not going to be included in the budget, but we'll tackle that in veto session, those few days the legislature meets in November, then forget it. That's just sort of pushing it off so you can smother it with a pillow in veto session. One of the problems, just as a matter of the machinations of government in Illinois, in veto session, it requires supermajorities, three-fifths supermajorities to pass anything. And, you know, this, even with, well, even with, because of Democrat supermajorities in the House and Senate, largely controlled by the teachers' unions and other public sector unions, not to mention a governor largely controlled by the teachers' union and other public sector unions, despite the fact he's a billionaire, he's controlled by them because of his political ambitions beyond the state of Illinois. So because of that situation, it is exceedingly unlikely that you could ever get 60% in both the House and the Senate and the governor to support an extension of the program if this got pushed to November. So that push to November is basically calling it over. But there's a possibility. There's a possibility that it could be resuscitated now. They adjourned last night to the General Assembly. They'll be back this morning. And let me posit this and get your reaction. Would you accept Republicans making a structured vote, agreeing to a structured vote on the budget, this terrible budget that Pritzker is, of course, propagandizing about, in exchange for salvaging and extending the tax credit scholarship program? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. In other words, Republicans agree to put some Republican votes on the budget in the House and the Senate in order that Democrats can run around saying, oh, we passed a bipartisan budget, which would be technically true, but substantively a lie because of this extortionary tactic. Give us votes for this and we'll allow the children to continue to enjoy their scholarships, children and families, because, of course, moms and dads are making these decisions. And as I said previously, talking about this, nobody's returning the scholarships. Have you noticed? Nobody's saying these scholarships, they're not worth it. I'm sending my kid back to the school, back to the neighborhood school that I'm forced to send him to if I can't afford a private school. Looking for the families that are doing that. So this deal, and by the way, not a balanced budget. We haven't had a balanced budget, real balanced budget, in more than two decades. So that's just a lie. And it's a lie told by Republican and Democrats and Republican and Democrat governors. But it continues to be a lie, including under Spalding. But what about that? A deal where you give the it will look like a bipartisan budget deal. And Republicans, some Republicans could potentially take heat. Why did you vote for Pritzker's budget? But the deal would be in exchange for salvaging and extending the one conservative reform policy achievement of the last 30 years. Here's what the IEA is doing in response to any doubt that Democrat socialists should move to kill this program. They're trying to start a race war, which is what the left is always in the business of doing. For all their talk of unity and post-racial harmony, I mean, I don't know how you achieve post-racial harmony when all you do is spend your time counting by race, but I digress. Here's a statement from the IEA, the Illinois Education Association. The association of all those wonderful teachers out there, because all teachers are wonderful, including the IEA apparatchiks, which is what percentage of IEA's membership? What percentage of teachers in the classroom? Well, here's what they posted, their website, Stop the Voucher Program. One of the country's biggest school voucher schemes is operating right here in Illinois. It began as a temporary five-year program under the guise of helping low-income and students of color to have a choice. However, the data shows more white students are helped than any other. Oh. So let's say that's true, you know, based on pluralities. Let's say that's true. Is that a reason to kill the program? We're not, we shouldn't be helping white students, low-income white students, you know, students from lower to middle-income families, the same way we help students from lower to middle-income black or Latino families or Asian families to access the same scholarship funds, to offer the same choices that the wealthy across the board, white, black, Latino, Asian, the same opportunities that those families have for their children. We should discriminate against low to middle-income white families based on their race. Really? You know, one of the constituencies that helped to propel the school choice program in Illinois, trade unions. Trade unions, their support was instrumental in passing the tax credit scholarships, the school choice program. And that includes a lot of lower to middle income white families. They shouldn't be, they shouldn't get any opportunities. Interesting. By the way, it's also interesting to note, as the Wall Street Journal did, despite this attempt by the Illinois Education Association to start a race war, survey of Illinois voters, the Illinois electorate, 61% approve of the program, including 67% of self-identified Democrats, 71% of black voters, and 81% of Hispanics statewide. Those are some big numbers. Big numbers. So either the tax credit scholarship folks have done just an incredible marketing program and done a real effective job of gaslighting all these Democrats and minority families, or over the course of the last 5 years, word has gotten out and families have benefited from the program and kids have benefited as well in terms of being able to go to a better school. And that word spreads within neighborhoods and communities, doesn't it? That's one explanation. The other explanation, I guess, offered by the IEA was that, oh, they're just being gaslit by that right-wing media. They're all listening to this show. They're all listening to conservatives talking about school choice. Or maybe not just what they know to be true in Illinois. They've also been paying some attention to all the school choice programs around the country, including in our neighboring Indiana, in our neighboring Iowa, in our neighboring Wisconsin. And they hear about the success of those programs, too. Maybe it's just the simple proposition, readily understandable, that, yeah, that would be great if I could have a choice for my kids' education that I can't otherwise afford, the same sort of choices that the politically connected and those that have more means have when it comes to their kids' schooling. Yeah, that makes sense to me. That's fair. Maybe that has something to do with it. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer. I mean, they should go ahead and go along with the budget of Republicans. They go along with everything else the Democrats do. I mean, they nearly speak up about anything for any conservative value in any shape, way, or form in the state of Illinois. And it's really unbelievable. It's like they're not even there. I mean, does anybody notice that they're not even there? So what would it matter if they go ahead and give them a few votes so they can falsely claim it's a bipartisan bill? You didn't even hear them speak up against anything in the budget. I mean, the audacity of the Democrats to spend money that Illinois doesn't have on illegal immigrants who are here totally illegally, and not to spend money on underprivileged kids to get a better education. It's like suicide. It's societal suicide.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Appreciate it. By the way, for you know, one of the other arguments that's made in addition, and it's secondary to starting this race war, which is what the teachers unions are interested in doing. Starving the public schools of resources. Yeah, right. $30,000 per pupil per kid in CPS. Illinois has the eighth highest per pupil education spending in the country at north of $17,000. And that's that number's 3 years old. So you can imagine where it is now. I mean, it is significantly more than all of our Midwestern neighbors. But the resources, the public schools, the government school systems are starved for resources. That's the argument. Right, right. And what do we know about how these public school systems are performing? Again, we've shared these numbers with you before. There's a very small percentage of minority students in Illinois that can either read or do grade or do math at grade level. This Illinois State Board of Education numbers from 2022, wirepoints.org did the research. Black students, 12% reading, 7% math, statewide. Only a small percentage of minority students in Illinois can read or do math at grade level. Black students reading 12%, math 7%. Hispanic students reading 18%, math 14%. And you, the response is to say that those families should be relegated to schools that have failed them and continue to fail their kids. And the other, I'll hold. Joe in Arlington Heights.
Good morning, Dan. I think the hypocrisy is just very painful. When the Safety Act was being pushed, a big fundamental behind it was poor people aren't able to bond out, and we have to have level the playing field. So it's not a system where the rich have an advantage. But they're doing the exact opposite to what their goal was with the Safety Act to children. They're saying, well, you poor people, you just languish here in failed schools and let the rich who can afford it have a better system.
Right.
And I think the comparison of the two really says a lot about just what craven, pandering, public sector union horrors our politicians are.
I think it does, too. Thanks for the call, Joe. And it's, of course, the irony of Pritzker, Welch, and Harmon standing before a podium yesterday announcing their budget deal, and Pritzker saying, yeah, tax credit scholarship's not in the budget. All three of those individuals who benefited from private schools, Harmon and Pritzker going to them, all three of them sending their kids to them. But not for you. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, you know, my late brother left behind two 10-year-olds and a 9-year-old. They live in the Forest Park School District, which will send them to Proviso East High School. And they need services, scholarship. I'm afraid because they're really white. They're like translucent white. They're so Irish. It's just unfair. I feel like the disbursement of services, and it's imbalanced. I'm almost speechless because I'm so emotionally worried about these children, because they're actually now in junior high now. It's been a couple of years since he died, and they need help. You know, white kids need help too, and to discriminate by race and color, and for people to support, you know, we got to support school choice. They pay a lot of taxes over there, and Forest Park schools are spending, I think it's 26 or 7,000 per kid. It's not like they don't have the money in the school system, because there's a lot of people who live in that town who don't go to the public schools. So spend it where, I don't even know what to say, Dan. It's like, it's so unfair and so screwed up.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Mike in the loop.
You know, I don't know what they're talking about taking, you know, I think this takes the load off the public schools. It doesn't put the burden on them. It takes kids out of the school system. So I don't know what this teachers union is talking about. And to be honest with you, this is such a dig in a lot of ways at the Catholic school system by not allowing these kids to go into it or stay there. And I don't think some of these politicians would care if the whole parochial school system shut down this afternoon. Wouldn't bother them a bit, it seems.
Except for, of course, the schools where their kids attend. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah. And a couple of reminders on this, too, per the teachers union's attempt to start a race war. We mentioned this per the Nancy Gianni op-ed over at johncastnews.com earlier in the week. 1 in 9 of the scholarship recipients are unique learners, meaning kids with special needs. So a kid who has a special need, well, if he's white, well, that's a problem. Is that what you're saying, teachers unions? The median income of scholarship recipients, the families, low $40,000 household income. That includes white families who struggle to get by, too. I don't really care about race, but the IEA does. Teachers unions do. The dumb identitarian socialists do. So that's the choice. And this is why, if there was a possibility to save this scholarship program and extend it, I feel morally compelled to promote that idea, because we have all these kids in this program now, and it's benefiting those kids and their families. It had another 5 years that that many more families and kids can participate, and that much greater of a constituency is built, a constituency that hopefully will be more vociferous in defending the program than the current constituency has been. And a constituency that hopefully in another 5 years, politicians beholden to the teachers unions, Republicans or Democrats, would be unable to ignore, much less undermine. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, trying to gauge the reaction. Amy's not in today, by the way, I should mention. So it's me flying solo. Anyway, trying to gauge the reaction of the FBI to the Durham report and all of the evidentiary-based assertions about what the FBI has been up to over the last half a dozen years, particularly, of course, as it pertains to President Trump, former President Trump. How seriously they take the, at minimum, breaches of professional conduct. Wondering about that? You can stop wondering, thanks to Representative August Pfluger. He's a Republican from Texas and a retired Air Force colonel, by the way. This is his exchange in a committee hearing with the FBI's Deputy Assistant Director of Counterintelligence, Jill Murphy. Texas congressman asking the FBI's Deputy Assistant Director of Counterintelligence, so senior level, about the Durham report.
Special Counsel Durham assessed that neither U.S. law enforcement nor the intelligence community appears to have possessed any actual evidence of collusion in their holdings at the commencement of the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, and that the Bureau subsequently discounted or willfully ignored material that did not support the narrative of a collusive relationship between Trump and Russia. As the Deputy Assistant Director for the FBI's Counterintelligence Division, are you familiar with this report?
I have not read that report, sir.
You have not read the Durham report?
I have not yet read the Durham report, no, sir.
I'm honestly speechless at this point in time. I'm not sure what to think of this as someone who has spent an entire career in counterintelligence. Special Counsel Durham found that the FBI moved too quickly with its investigation of the 2016 campaign and relied on uncorroborated evidence when launching its investigation. Does this concern you?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
That there was a very fast pace of the investigation and that uncorroborated evidence was used when launching the investigation. Does that concern you?
So again, sir, I haven't read the Durham report, so I'm not sure, you know, I have no knowledge of...
Does this fall under the counterintelligence umbrella?
The Durham report? I'm sure portions of it do, yes, sir.
Does a suggestion or an accusation of election collusion between a foreign government and the United States or a person or an entity in the United States fall under counterintelligence?
Yes, sir.
So the alleged collusion between Mr. Trump in 2016 and Russia would have fallen under the counterintelligence division of the FBI?
Yes, sir.
And you have not read the Durham report?
I have not read the Durham report.
Is there a reason? Is it not required to?
No, I just haven't had time.
Ms. Murphy, do you actively investigate counterintelligence with foreign entities around the world?
Yes, sir.
And this is a sincere question. Does election collusion worry you?
Yeah, obviously election collusion would worry me. Yes, sir.
Does any malign influence to the United States worry you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would highly recommend reading that because we spent 4 years discussing that. There was uncorroborated evidence. The Durham report specifically outlines the outcome of that. It's very disappointing to hear this.
The Durham report was issued almost 2 weeks ago. She obviously knew that she was going to be before a House committee, and you know, she probably had some idea they may ask her about the contents of the Durham report, since, as she conceded, so much of its contents directly relate to her job as the Deputy Assistant Counterintelligence Director for the FBI. I didn't have time. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Didn't get around to it. Did you listen to this? Did you have the same feeling I did, like it was watching a teacher ask a student why they didn't turn in their homework? Why they didn't read a book that was assigned in class? I don't have time. Is reading this book important? You know, is getting a good grade in this class important to you? Oh, yes, sir. It's important to me. Well, you might want to go ahead and do the assignments associated with this class if you want that good grade. Is doing your job important to you? Yes, yes, sir. Oh, yes, very important to me. Well, then maybe you want to do the work associated with doing your job. That's what accountability at the FBI sounds like. All the pronouncements and protestations of Christopher Wray and the Beltway establishment notwithstanding. I haven't read the Durham report. No comment on it. Didn't get around to it. Oh, she's got so many busy things to do that keep her busy. Protecting us from, you know, Donald Trump and other Republican candidates. Protecting the Biden family from pesky subpoenas from Jim Comer. Oh, by the way, speaking of which, Jim Comer, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, is threatening to initiate contempt of Congress proceedings against Christopher Wray, the FBI director, who continues to defy his subpoena. The FBI has failed to produce the unclassified record that alleges a criminal bribery scheme involving then-VP Joe Biden and a foreign national. The record is 2 weeks past due. Didn't get around to it. I'm busy. I don't have time for congressional subpoenas. Is responding to congressional subpoenas, is that something you take seriously? Oh, yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. Well, why haven't you done it? Been busy. I mean, could they essentially offer a sanitized FU to members of Congress and by extension the American public? Could it be any more obvious? A Representative Pfluger and the American people who are interested in this, go F yourself. That's what your FBI Deputy Assistant Director of Counterintelligence just said. FBI staff, this going back to the subpoena. I take it seriously. Of course I take it seriously. It's a serious thing. Why don't you do it? I got stuff going. The FBI staff and this subpoena from Comer said the subpoena was too broad because there were so many responsive documents containing the term Biden in the confidential human source database that they were searching to comply with this subpoena for a unclassified record alleging a criminal bribery scheme between the then Vice President Joe Biden and a foreign national. So Chairman Comer narrowed the scope of the subpoena by providing two additional items, June 30, 2020, and $5 million. Those are pretty specific. Think about it as a Google search. You did a document search. Yeah, it's not just Biden. Oh, I got a lot of returns. Biden, June 30th, 2020, specific date, specific amount. Nope. And so he sent a letter threatening to initiate contempt proceedings. But this is who you're dealing with. So, again, all the protestations and pronouncements of reform and responsiveness and accountability. Take those things very seriously. Do we exhibit them? No. No. We take them seriously, though. That's all you need to know. Clay in Libertyville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. She doesn't care about the Durham Report, and I don't care about the Durham Report. And it's simple. Nobody's getting arrested. Nobody will be arrested. Nobody will be prosecuted. So why should I care about this report? I already knew everything that was going on. We've been saying this for months, years. We knew what was going on. So she doesn't care. I don't care. Unless somebody gets arrested. Thanks, Dan.
All right, Clay. Steve, Northwest Side.
I was a policeman in Chicago for over 30 years. I've worked with the FBI from time to time. I've always gotten along with them. I'm not a hater. I didn't dislike them like a substantial number of policemen in Chicago do. But I now have come to the conclusion that it's time to disband the FBI. They answer to no one. They are a law unto themselves. They refuse to answer questions Congress puts before them. They refuse to respond to subpoenas or supply documents Congress requests. They need to be quashed now. They become like a semi-Stasi, if not a complete Stasi, or a KGB.
Thanks for the call, Steve. IRS, you've gotten the same sort of responsiveness in quotation marks from Danny Werfel, the IRS commissioner. Not that Danny Werfel. Not from University of Florida days. Briefly, Chicago Bears days. Spelled differently. Don't want to impugn the good name of Danny Werfel, the quarterback, by confusing with Danny Werfel, the IRS commissioner. You know those IRS whistleblowers that are alleging the IRS essentially is spiking the investigation into Hunter Biden and, by extension, Biden Inc.? Well, one of the whistleblowers has now been named, Just the News, John Solomon's media outlet, confirmed that the one of the whistleblowers is Supervisory Criminal Investigative Agent Gary Shapley, and he is going to talk tomorrow to a House committee about the specifics of what happened in the five-year-long investigation of Hunter. In addition, we have another IRS agent who was part of this investigation. And remember, the allegation is that the entire team was removed from the case by the Department of Justice. which what the whistleblowers are saying is an act of retaliation. The subordinate that has also communicated to Congress, has also blown the whistle, as it were, had, and his name has not been disclosed, at least not since that I've seen, indicated that both Mr. Shapley's attempts and his efforts to call attention to pervasive problems affecting the investigation into Hunter Biden have gone on for much longer, saying, for the last couple years, my supervisor and I have tried to gain the attention of our senior leadership about certain issues prevalent regarding the investigation. I've asked for countless meetings with our chief and deputy chief, often to be left out on an island and not heard from. The lack of IRS senior leadership involvement is deeply troubling and unacceptable. That's what the case agent communicated to the IRS commissioner in a letter. Said, oh, yeah, no, I take this stuff very seriously. Oh, of course you do. Of course you do. So here's the problem. It seems like it's an institutional problem, not just a personnel problem. Whether it's at the IRS or FBI, these agencies in particular, Department of Justice as well, really, you can talk chapter and verse about how the good, how many good people there are and how the majority of the employees at these agencies are patriotic Americans that are fulfilling their constitutional oath. But the problem is, at the senior leadership level, it seems like no matter who is president, the senior leadership level of these agencies has a different program, has a Beltway program, has a uniparty program. And that program thwarts the efforts of people underneath them to do the work they were hired to do that they swore to do. And those people who are patriotic and even-handed and believe in equal protection before the law and believe in meeting out justice in that vein, they don't rise to the levels of senior leadership, at least not anymore. Maybe once upon a time they did, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest in the past, particularly at these agencies, no, not really. And even if you get a presidential nominee confirmed by the Senate to be the titular head of the agency, you still have the institutional senior leadership that seems to me is a bulwark against due process and equal protection before the law. And until there is something delivered that is even within the realm of accountability, that gets their attention, so they do their homework before they appear before a House congressional committee. Do their homework. Nah, I've read it. Busy. Until something fundamentally impacts the way these agencies operate in terms of funding or restructuring or scaling down, then you're going to get the kind of responses that you're getting from Jim Comey to Jim Comer, that you got from the Deputy Assistant Director of Counterintelligence to that representative from Texas. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, but no Amy today, she's off, so it's just me. Cori Bush, socialist spice girl from St. Louis, she's busy, got a lot of things on her plate. When she is not proposing a $14 trillion reparations plan, yeah, $14 trillion with a T, she is explaining that the Biden administration is not looking to ban gas stoves. They're looking to do something else, something important, save lives.
This proposed rule is not a ban on gas stoves. This proposed rule is not a ban on gas stoves. We are regulating indoor air pollution.
Mm. it's a regulation of indoor air pollution. She wanted to say, I can only imagine the number of my constituencies who are unknowingly being poisoned by their gas stoves without this proposed rule being in effect. Now, the proposed rule would, according to the industry, eliminate about half of the gas stoves on the market. So I guess that's not a complete ban, but it's certainly going to make provide less choice and more expense if you did want a gas stove. Richard Trumka, remember him? Head of the AFL-CIO. He's also a Biden appointee to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It's a hidden hazard. Any option is on the table. Products that can't be made safe can be banned. Well, saving lives. Saving lives. That's what regulators are always doing. They're saving lives. Is there been any evidentiary support presented that gas stoves are some sort of silent killer? If somebody's seen that, please direct my attention to it. I guess just saying that this is to regulate indoor pollution is good enough. For more on this regulatory topic and others, please be joined by Scott the Cow Guy Shellady, market specialist for Market Day Report, 10:30 to 1 Chicago time, and the Cow Guy Close, 1 to 1:30, both at RFD TV. Scott the Cow Guy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
You're not advocating polluting the indoors. You're not defending the silent killer that is the gas stove, are you?
I'm advocating for exactly what my father used to tell me when I was an idiot. And he would say, why aren't you worried about something that might happen, numbnuts?
Yeah.
So it all stems from the fact that, the NAACP is put a travel warning on Florida, but they don't put a travel warning on Baltimore and Chicago. Mm-hmm. They want to worry about your indoor pollution in Cordova Bush's district in St. Louis, whatever that may be, but she doesn't care about all the people and the gunfighting and the crime and all the people that are actually dying of real things. So these people want to regulate things like masks when you have a virus that's running rampant through the country, but when we actually do have something in the air that is hurting people in East Palestine, there's not a mask to be seen for miles. So they regulate things that aren't going to happen and let things that definitely are going to happen happen, and it's to the detriment of everybody that touches them.
Yeah, it's interesting, the mask comparison, too, because there are exemptions for important people when it comes to gas stoves, too. Like, for example, Jose Andres, the celebrity chef, he's got that bizarre meat on Wacker and Randolph. That's Jose Andres. But he is going to get an exemption from the California gas stove regulations because he's Jose Andres, you see.
Yeah, he's probably just got a bunch of undocumented people working in his kitchen so that, you know, they don't really care anyway. That's just ridiculous. As my father said, worry about something that's going to happen. And every time I see these minute, the control is down to the minutia, but they really miss the big picture. I mean, that's what Pete Buttigieg has done for his job. I mean, he regulates the minutia, but lets the huge things happen. And I don't understand. They would be much better off by worrying about having people travel to Chicago and Baltimore rather than putting out problems, putting out edicts about traveling to Florida. I still can't get over the fact that you actually had something you could see, right? You couldn't see the virus. Nobody could see COVID. But you could see this horrible black cloud of smoke emanating from East Palestine, Ohio, and everybody's showing up there, and nobody's got one mask on yet, and everybody's complaining about respiratory problems. Where are they? I mean, the level of hypocrisy is astounding. And again, things that are actually happening, they don't care about, they want to regulate the minutia that's never going to. I did not realize that gas stoves were killing that many people. I'd like to know the number of people it kills every year.
Yeah, me too. Well, maybe if Jose Andres moved to East Palestine, Ohio, maybe they'd get a little bit more consideration. Speaking of things that may or may not happen, your take and your read on the market's take on this debt ceiling melodrama that's playing itself out, largely it seems over the work requirement for welfare recipients as much as even the spending differences.
Well, I mean, the spending differences are such that one of them, you know, one of them is only slightly better than the other. I mean, if the Republicans are really going to draw a line, I wish it would have been something a little bit more harsh. But
well, maybe it's the work requirement, which is not unsubstantial.
And doesn't that tell you where we are as a country? I mean, the fact that you're an able-bodied person with no dependents and you're getting benefits and you don't want to do anything for them, that tells you exactly where this country is. I mean, my country changed dramatically when Vince Lombardi died and Bobby Knight got fired. I mean, everything went downhill from there.
Okay? That's the watershed moment?
That was my watershed moment
when everything
changed.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you've got folks that are much more willing, and people are rewarding them for staying home. People are doing, you know, coming up with these dumb ideas about universal basic income, which has failed miserably everywhere else they've done it in the world. But when we're going to do it differently here and reward people for sitting at home and give them money for nothing. And now you've conditioned these people to think that they're owed that. And so, yeah, they don't want to work for government benefits. I mean, workfare is common sense. But, again, there you go. Common sense isn't that common anymore. These types of things just are a great reflection of where we've come as a society. Another one of those things that they want is to claw back money that nobody's used for COVID because COVID's over. I don't understand how there's even how can you get angry about that? COVID's over. You didn't spend it. Can you have it back, please?
But does,
what's the problem?
But is if with respect to Wall Street, I know there's sort of, you know, general anxiety all the time about everything. But is there real belief that the United States would default on its debt? Does anybody on the street believe that?
No. I mean, amongst the chattering classes, you know, the guys that I've dealt with for the last 35 years, no. But here's the problem, right? It's when you walk into a negotiation, like McCarthy's been doing, and he's been doing an okay job. But, I mean, if you walk in and you say, just want to let everybody know, we can't afford to default. It takes all the wind out of your sails. You've got no leverage anymore. And so, to some degree, Dan, as much as sometimes he's crazy, you know, Trump, a lot of folks said, oh, that was very irresponsible for him when he said, I would just default. I don't believe he believes that. But I know that he's a decent negotiator, and he can't walk into a meeting giving away the only thing you've got to hold over anybody's head. And I think that that's the problem, is there's no leverage. I mean, yes, we're getting someplace, and they're trying to cajole society to come along to your side so that finally Biden will flip and do something. But at the end of the day, the path that the Republicans want to put us on versus the path that the Democrats want to put us on reminds me a lot about when they reopened restaurants to 25% capacity. We're just going to go out of business slower.
I wanted to get your take too on where you think the markets are at, since this is your specialty. Because, you know, I mentioned this to Steve Moore yesterday, this Don Luskin piece in the Wall Street Journal, where he's now expressing concern, as he did actually previously, about deflation in the next year because of the combination of the money supply declining and the Fed action on interest rates. And I wonder if you have the same concern that we are past sort of the peak of inflation and it is steadily declining, and that Jay Powell needs to take his foot off the pedal with interest rate hikes and you know, allow the productive capacity of the economy to be less shackled.
Yeah, I 100% understand that. And I think the thing that also needs to be put in there is AI, artificial intelligence. I think ultimately that will end up being very deflationary and right now, let's just say out of the 90% of the, let's say 10% of the stocks or 10 stocks in the S&P 500 are responsible for 90% of the gains. 10 stocks are responsible for 90%, and they're all AI stocks, or they all have something to do with AI. AI is already making a big impact on money because a lot of the things that have done well this year, you know, have artificial intelligence in them. And I do think that the Fed has tightened at a historic pace. I think inflation, the annual rate of inflation, although it's not as high as it was, look, we're at 4.9%. 4.9% means things are 4.9% more expensive this year than they were this time last year. But this time last year, things were 8.3% more expensive. That's why the consumer's getting killed. Food, fuel, and rent are still very high. And I think that because of the gains that people are looking at in the stock market as something that's good, I say is much too narrow. And I think that the economy is still on very, very narrow footing, which would be easily toppled over. But slowly but surely, you've got smarter people, I think, than a lot of people out there are giving up the ghost on trying to be short the market or think it's going to go down, and are jumping in on this bandwagon that things are going to be great and artificial intelligence is going to be something that's going to take these stock markets to new highs. But I still think that the economy is very, very shaky. And I think in a large degree that is because the interest rate hikes have been so fast and furious. We've gone from 0 to 5%. I am supportive of slowing their roll. But because I listen to what they say, they're so hell-bent on getting that 4.9% inflation down to 2%. That I have to actually listen to what they say rather than think what I think they should do. And I feel like that they're going to be overly aggressive, and that's why I'm bearish on the economy and stock markets, because I think that they're going to continue to really break this thing because I've said this to you before, I think it's criminal. They've actually said it out loud. Jay Powell has said it out loud that we need to go into a recession and people need to be put out of work to get inflation under control. But what he doesn't say is the inflation that I let get out of hand, which was my fault. So because of what I did, I need to put you all out of work and throw the country in maybe a mild recession to make up for the error on my ways. He said that, and I think that it's unbelievable that that's the situation we're in. But because he said it, I got to listen to it. And so I think that that's the reason why I'm bearish on things, because I think that they're going to really screw it up.
I wanted to get your take on something. Our friend Jim Perry, who's also a market analyst, wrote in a recent posting. It flies in formation with what you just said about 10% of the equities responsible for 90% of the gains. 10, literally the number 10. He asked the question, wondering why your actively managed big cap equity fund is underperforming the S&P 500 index. Only 29% of equities in the S&P are beating the index. It's the lowest since 1998. He calls that stunning in terms of the point that you were making. Yes. So so despite what you're seeing sort of top line, and I'm sure a lot of investors are seeing this with respect to their accounts, but despite what you're seeing at the top line, you really have to be throwing bullseyes to be making money in the market right now. And it would seem to me that if Jay Powell is the typical political animal that he seems to be, that you get at the Fed, that he would be interested in propping up this market a little bit more broadly, as you say, as compared to how narrow it is right now. And that means pressing the pause button. That in the combination with the danger of more regional banks failing.
Yeah, and if you look at, the bond market's bigger than the stock market, right? There's more money in bonds in the U.S. than stocks. A lot of people don't know that. But the bond market, actually, if you look at, say, euro dollars and Fed funds and the things like that we talk about all the time with your friend Jim Uriel, a lot of those things are pricing in interest rate cuts between now and December of 2024. And some of them quite substantial, because the smart money knows how narrow and how shoddy this all is. And if we do ultimately end up getting some rate cuts, it's not going to be because things are great and everybody's skipping down the yellow brick road. It'll be because of some sort of financial calamity that we've had to cut interest rates. That's what we're facing. I mean, the bond markets are telling us a different story than these very narrow indices that are are higher on the year by 8%. But if you say, you know, that's the stock market, the S&P, up 8% on the year. But if you actually make those all those 500 stocks in the S&P 500 equally weighted, not weight the bigger ones more and less, equally weighted, it's basically flat. I mean, so there's all these metrics out there that just tell me that we have got some serious concerns. And by the way, you don't have three bank failures when your economy is roaring right along, right? You don't see all the layoffs. I mean, look, all the smart money out there, the Amazons, the tech companies that actually have the metrics that can see around the corner of the economy and go, and these people are laying off people left, right, and center. There's not anybody hiring anybody. And then you have the CEO of IBM saying, I'm not going to hire these 8,000 people because I can get those jobs done by AI. We've got some serious issues, but everybody's, you know, whistling by the graveyard right now because, hey, look at all the stock markets. They're up on the year. Well, guess what? I think that could change in a heartbeat. It only takes 10 stocks to change it all.
Scott, the Cow Guy, Shelley, market specialist for Market Day Report, 10:30 to 1. The Cow Guy close, 1 to 1:30, both at RFD TV. Scott, the Cow Guy, thanks as always.
I'm going to see you.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy is off today, so it's just me. And by the way, I mean, yeah, need to offer a few more tributes to the passing of the great Tina Turner. How about this one?
We are the children.
Perfectly appropriate for Chicago since we live in the Thunderdome.
We are the ones.
We've got a Thunderdome sort of contest brewing between DeSantis and Trump. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis entering the presidential contest yesterday formally in that interview he did on Twitter with Elon Musk. There were some technical difficulties because more than 700,000 people tuned in to watch the interview, which says a lot about the interest in Ron DeSantis' campaign. His campaign reporting that he raised $1 million in online donations in the first hour after his announcement. So definitely some interest there among Republican primary voters. And the technical difficulties is something that Trump seized on to say that the launch was a failed one and that his whole campaign is going to be similarly catastrophic. That's a bit hyperbolic, I think. But let's do a little compare on the issues, because perhaps the more expansive discussion of the issues, more coverage of more issues, didn't happen with Elon Musk, but happened with Trey Gowdy, Ron DeSantis granting his first interview post-announcement to his former colleague, Trey Gowdy, who's got a show on Fox, as you know. And I understand that this is not just about taking positions on issues, that this is about the feel you have for the individual candidate, the belief you have that he can do what he says he is going to do or what he says he wants to do. And so there's a prove up or there's a persuasion that's required. So the combination of DeSantis's record plus what he had to say about salient issues. The question is Ron DeSantis proving up for you, at least proving up to be somebody for consideration, even if you're inclined to Trump. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Or, frankly, inclined to somebody like Tim Scott or Nikki Haley or Vivek Ramaswamy or Mike Pence, because if you're inclined to one of those candidates and it does materialize into a two-man race, doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen, but if it does, where it's at now, then are you willing to come off of a Tim Scott or Vivek Ramaswamy or Nikki Haley to support Ron DeSantis if you want to see someone other than Trump as the nominee? So that's the, you know, multivariate equation that Ron DeSantis has to solve to get it to a two-man race. But here's Ron DeSantis on the FBI, a salient topic we played earlier in the program, just one of the most astounding back and forths when the first deputy director, or that I think she's the assistant deputy director, whatever they call it, deputy director of the counterintel division at the FBI, Jill Murphy's her name, under questioning from a Texas Republican congressman about the Durham report, which was issued almost 2 weeks ago. And despite conceding that much of the contents of the Durham report falls under her purview, given her position at the FBI, I haven't read it. Been busy. What does Ron DeSantis want to do about that sort of imperious attitude and behavior at FBI?
No, I would not keep Chris Reyes, director of the FBI. There'd be a new one on day one. I think that's very important. In terms of an attorney general, you need someone that's got a really strong backbone. You need somebody that knows if you're going in there and you're taking care of business, the Washington Post is not going to like you. New York Times is not going to like you. You're going to get attacked by CNN, and you got to wear that as a badge of honor. You can't try to please polite society, because otherwise you'll just get captured by the institution itself. And I think the DOJ and FBI have lost their way. I think that they've been weaponized against Americans who think like me and you, and I think that they become very partisan. Part of the reason that's happened, Trey, is because Republican presidents have accepted the canard that the DOJ and FBI are, quote, independent. They are not independent agencies. They are part of the executive branch. They answer to the elected president of the United States. So as president, you have a responsibility to be involved in holding those agencies accountable, clearing out people who are not doing the job, and making sure that they're doing the people's business and they're not abusing their authority. For example, if the FBI or DOJ would ever collude with a tech company to try to censor information, everybody involved with that would be fired immediately if I were the president. And right now, I think those agencies have been able to go without any real accountability. And so guess what? When there's no accountability, the bad behavior is going to continue.
Pretty strong answer in my view. And the thing I like about Ron DeSantis, as I mentioned before, is his level of specificity, his command of the details. So here, part of the command of the details is to understand how our government's actually set up, so you don't fall into the trap of starting from the premise of the left. The premise of the left, as he just said, oh, the DOJ and the FBI are independent. Actually, they're not. They're part of the executive branch, which is why on day one, I can fire Chris Wray and nominate somebody else for Senate confirmation, which is why President Trump could fire Jim Comey. It just took him too long to do it. And by the way, I'm not saying that firing Chris Wray is the beginning and the end of oversight, but neither is Ron DeSantis. If there were FBI agents that were bad actors engaged in colluding with tech companies, for example, as we know from the Twitter files, writing memos targeting Catholics who attend Latin Mass, as we know from the Richmond office, then I would go in and hold those agents responsible and perhaps their supervisors and get rid of them. And if my director didn't want to do it, I'd get a new director. Now, he didn't say all that, but it's sort of implied. And that's exactly the position you needed to take. That's exactly the shock to the system at FBI and DOJ that's required, including perhaps a general reconsideration of the expanse of its power and roles in our society, law enforcement roles in our society. doesn't start from the premise that they're independent. That's not to say it's my attorney general, it's my FBI director. No, the attorney general is the attorney general for the citizens of the United States, and so is the FBI director. It's not my toady, but let's just be clear about how our government's set up, since the D.C. press corps doesn't seem to understand it. I have executive oversight over those agencies. I'm swearing an oath to exercise that oversight, and I'm going to exercise that oversight. And you know what? Based on what he did with the prosecutor in Florida, who said, I'm not going to enforce laws that I don't want to enforce when it comes to the range of issues, but specifically abortion. Okay, well, then you're out. I have power as the governor of Florida. Not every governor has power, but he does in Florida, and he used it. So there's a position he's taken, but there's a record where he's used his executive power appropriately in furtherance of equal treatment before the law and in furtherance of making sure that those with law enforcement power exercise that power judiciously and even-handedly. So there's a record. That's a pretty good dot connected to me. Just as one example. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Jesse and McHenry.
Yeah, good morning. I'm just calling to say that if the election were held today, I'd probably be going for Tim Scott. But if it comes down between DeSantis and Trump, I'm going to have to go with DeSantis.
Why are you with Tim Scott at present?
Well, presently, I mean, just, you know, over the years, I've liked what he's had to say. I liked how he's been in the Senate, and I believe he's level-headed. Not to say that DeSantis isn't necessarily good or level-headed, but I would have to take Tim Scott.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jesse. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, in the movie Hoffa, I don't know if you remember it, when Jack Nicholson, he played Hoffa. Once he gets elected to the union, he turns to Fitzy, who's played by J.T. Walsh, and he gives him a list of people that needed to be fired immediately. And I'm surprised that Trump didn't do that in his first week in office. Why weren't some of these people just fired? You know, he didn't really understand the executive branch. You know, the Justice Department, to your point earlier, they were created in 1871. To deal with many problems that were caused by the Southern Democrats. They're part of the Enforcement Acts of the early 1870s under Grant. So they are they're not an independent agency. They are part of the executive branch that is subject to oversight by the president. And why does the FBI director have a 10-year term? That's something that needs to change, too. The FBI director is not like a Federal Reserve Board governor shouldn't be like that with a 14-year term. It should be shorter. It's one way to make it more accountable. So anyway, those are my thoughts today.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. Mike and Dixon.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say that I don't think that DeSantis is going to do enough. I mean, just taking the top guys down, when you have over 200,000 people being surveilled, how many agents does that take? I mean, you need someone who's going to dismantle it. And I believe Trump has said he'll do that, CIA included. So I think you have to burn it down. I don't think DeSantis is doing enough.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, I'm not sure. They didn't go into more depth in terms of what DeSantis might be willing to do in, again, rethinking, as I said, the scope and the power of some of these federal agencies. But, you know, being clear on personnel choices and the willingness to use executive power, the legitimate executive power the president possesses, that's a pretty good start. You know, saying I'll dismantle it or I'll burn it down. Well, it is more complicated than that. And I get it gives you an indication of disposition. But I mean, I just, you know, my preference in terms of management style as well as communication style is DeSantis. Granular knowledge, real day-to-day engagement, and the ability to attack the false premises of the left with cogent arguments. Those are pretty attractive qualities. And I think, DeSantis is, he is no wallflower, by the way. I know that people like Trump's pugnacious attitude towards his adversaries, and I do to a large extent as well. But, I mean, DeSantis is no shrinking violet here, as we've seen during his 5 years as governor, and to some extent in Congress, too, but particularly as governor. I mean, the closest thing to a Howard Roark in a governor's mansion that we had during COVID was Ron DeSantis. He was willing to stand against the world, at least the political world. Something to be said for that. Paul in Effingham, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, how are you doing? I think Democrats are so afraid of DeSantis in a swing state, and even like in the state of Illinois, because he's so popular between the people, all the different people who travel to Florida or want to be like Florida in those states.
Well, thanks for the call, Paul. Appreciate that. We'll see. There's a much longer getting to know you phase that Ron DeSantis is going to go through than obviously Trump. So we'll see, but now to the argument for Trump supporters, the idea that DeSantis is advancing, that only he can beat Joe Biden. Well, the polling doesn't say that right now. Snapshot in time, I understand. But, there's a Harvard-Harris poll that has actually Trump beating Joe Biden and DeSantis not beating Joe Biden. Now, these polls are all close. They're both winning by a couple. They're both losing by a couple. One has Trump up on Biden and DeSantis down on Biden. But I'm just saying it is not obvious from the polling that Ron DeSantis is the only candidate who can defeat Joe Biden or whoever the Democrats would put up, even if you zero down the polling from the national to what's actually relevant, the state by state and specifically the swing states. That's just not at all clear. Trump's numbers in the Rust Belt, according to that same Harvard-Harris poll, are better than DeSantis's right now. So, as long as that is sustained by Trump, that's going to undermine one of the electoral arguments that DeSantis has. Marco in Romeoville.
Morning. Yeah, I like DeSantis, but I have a feeling that Trump's going to have the edge because nobody wants that idiot in the office right now, again. And the way DeSantis playing the card, he's going to scare most of the land vote because of what his laws are doing right now over there in Florida. So Trump's going to win at the end.
All right. Thanks, Marco. Doug, South Loop. Hey, Doug, South Loop.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I wanted to pick up on something you said about Trump sounding so much more pugnacious on an issue, and he does. And it's very attractive. Nobody sounded more aggressive and was finally going to settle the border problem and finally get a wall. That was the forget-about-it issue, that if he is elected, now what do we have? We had a Republican Congress, Republican Senate, and we have all 40 miles of wall built. It was completely abandoned. Yet he talked tough, and that was good enough. I hope this time around people start distinguishing between hearing something very smart, like what DeSantis just said, about these are not independent agencies, because it's been drilled in our head. He's really identified a problem that everybody kind of has absorbed through these Democratic administrations, that somehow the DOJ is independent. But it is not. And this type of thinking, but if you just respond to, hey, I'm going to shut the whole damn thing down, I promise you, nothing of that sort will happen. Don't respond to that stuff.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Doug. I mean, the border wall thing, I know people, Trump supporters, ascribe the blame to Paul Ryan and House Republicans, and Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans. And there's some truth to that. But, you're the president. You made this promise. Did you devote the political capital right at the outset to zero focus everybody's attention, to bring everything to a halt until that was delivered, to put the kind of pressure a president can put on legislative leaders to comply? to advance his policy agenda, the policy agenda that the people voted for? Did he? Now, was that inexperience? Was that lack of attention span? Was that not understanding the nuances of the people with whom he was dealing in the Republican caucuses? Whatever it wasn't delivered. That's just a fact. Now, again, you can go into the ascribing blame game, but right, tough talk is not the end-all be-all. And this is not to say that Trump didn't accomplish a lot and didn't expose a lot, because he did on both counts, and we can go through that. But I mean, let's just be honest about ourselves with respect to some of what was said matched up against what was done. Matt Southside.
Hey, good morning, Dan. A couple things real quick. You just actually hit on it. I think one of the things was nobody knew how corrupt these agencies were until it was exposed with Trump being president. The other thing is I personally like DeSantis a lot more than I like a Greg Abbott or a Brian Kemp. But I feel like Brian Kemp actually opened Georgia first. I feel like Greg Abbott started sending the migrants first to other sanctuary cities. And I feel like DeSantis tends to jump on things once he realizes they're popular with the Republican base.
Thanks for the call, Matt. Appreciate it. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, Dan, I hate qualifiers, but I'm going to throw one in that I don't include you in this. Frank from Arlington Heights mentioned the movie Hoffa. There's a scene in there where Bobby Charles approached by an FBI agent saying, you could turn on Hoffa as well, and you'd get your immunity. Well, here's one Trump supporter that doesn't want immunity from being a Trump supporter. I supported Trump. He was up against the world. He was up against the world. And while there's going to be never Trumpers out there abandoning ship, I'm sidling up with no jerks from Deer Park because Ron DeSantis is more polished. I'll stay with my guy.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tom. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy's off today, so it's just me. Well, this was an interesting development, an unsurprising one, based on previous spending history highlighted by former Black Lives Matter. I'm talking about Black Lives Matter, Inc., not sort of the Marxist movement, but the actual corporate entity. The spending of Black Lives Matter, Inc. under the direction of Patrice Cullors when they were buying up homes, $1 million worth of homes and so forth. Black Lives Matter tax documents show executives within the organization raked in millions, while the group overall ended with nearly $9 million in the red. They ended the financial year $8.559 million in a deficit, which represents quite a decline from the $42 million that Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation raked in last year. Group garnered $8.5 million this past financial year, but spent $17 million on expenses. Those expenses, the executives. $1.69 million for management and consulting services paid to a company owned by Shelemiah Bowers, who replaced Patrice Cullors, who I just mentioned. Yeah. So old boss just like the new boss, or new boss just like the old boss. Uh-huh. Now there's all sorts of lawsuits going back and forth accusing people of siphoning off millions of dollars and so forth. Tell me again about your commitment to to redistribution. You dyed-in-the-wool Marxists, right? Redistribution from you to me is the redistribution they support. And this is all about advancing the flag for their particular policies, like defunding police, while they're defunding Black Lives Matter Global Foundation and putting it in their pockets. Mm-hmm. Inspired leadership. For more on the policy side of it, but I did want to get in the financial management. Maybe that will send a signal to all of those Fortune 500 companies that poured so much money into Black Lives Matter as some sort of tribute to don't target me, we'll give you cash. The old Jesse Jackson shakedown operation still works, apparently. But on the policy side, we're pleased to be joined by psychology professor Chris Ferguson. He is at Stetson University in Florida. He's the author of Catastrophe, The Psychology of Why Good People Make Bad Situations Worse. And he has recently written on how Black Lives Matter got police violence wrong. Professor Ferguson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on today.
So interesting piece that you posted over at realclearinvestigations.com. And let's start with race relations before we get to Black Lives Matter specifically and the collapse of race relations, because it's a story that's been told, but I think it needs a retelling given the racial polarization and the race wars that are being instigated by so many on the left. I talked actually earlier in the show today, the Illinois Education Association in the state of Illinois, teachers union here, in their attack on the tax credit scholarship program. One of the arguments they make is that more plurality of kids benefiting from the program are white kids. That's an indictment of the program, according to them, even though what all the kids have in common, white, black, Latino, Asian, is that they're from moderate income households. And that's why they qualify for the scholarships. But if you're white, you're guilty. So that's a problem. So we can't have a plurality of whites benefiting from any program, even if they're similarly situated to their minority counterparts financially. And so that's where we're at. That's, I think, a good example of where we're at. We have neo-segregation going on in classrooms. That's a real good example of where we're at. And all of this is belied by the promise of electing the first black president who was going to unify our country and move us in a direction of colorblindness. What's happened in the last 15 years?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about the data on race relations is if you look at the trends, you see that through most of the early 2000s, that most people, whether they were black or white, had relatively positive views of race relations in the U.S. Yeah, it wasn't perfect, of course, but you know, majorities of citizens, both white and black, you know, kind of felt like things were moving in the correct direction. And that was really fairly stable through the Bush years. It was really stable through most of the Obama years. And then in 2014, you see this, the beginning of a massive drop-off of this for both white and black citizens. And that drop-off has continued through the present day. So that's led a lot of people to kind of wonder, you know, what happened in around 2013, 2014 to kind of start this process moving along. Now, if you look at the actual, like, numbers of how people are doing in society, you know, any of these issues that we're talking about, whether it's, you know, police shootings or, you know, issues in education or jobs, that things have not really gotten worse. You know, there's not any evidence of, like, more racism in the United States, for instance. You know, police shootings are down, not up. You know, jobs come and go, of course, but, you know, generally speaking, the economy has not gotten, you know, worse in the sense of it hitting, you know, black Americans or Latino Americans differently from white Americans, for instance. So, you know, there's really nothing in the numbers that suggests the U.S. has gotten worse in terms of things like racism. If anything, quite the opposite. So it becomes a question of, well, why did all of a sudden in 2014 everybody start to decide that things had gotten worse, you know, in terms of race relations in the U.S.? And I think what people are kind of tying it down to is that was really the start of what a journalist named Maddie Iglesias called this the Great Awakening, if you will. It really was, you know, this kind of like focus on identity and race and the idea that, you know, the United States is fundamentally racist, and these narratives kind of promulgated in the news media. And that kind of put everybody in a bad mood about this issue. So it's really interesting to see this, like, the divergence between the numbers suggesting that, you know, Americans are less racist than they've ever been, you know, racism is down, and on the other hand, everybody's sort of upset about this issue of race. So I think we really need to take a real clear look at why that happened and how we can reverse that.
Well, right. I mean, and this is some of what you document has also been documented by Harvard economist Roland Fryer, by Raphael Mangual at the Manhattan Institute. I mean, the data is incontrovertible. I mean, Roland Fryer, who's a black gentleman, in addition to being a Harvard econ professor, said, you know, I went into this essentially like I was suspicious that about what I found. I didn't think I was going to believe the narrative that others had told, that there's just no evidence to support that black men are being targeted by police, or that the incidence of police shootings is demonstrably race-based. Right. But you know, the data is the data. I'm an economist. And so he had to concede the point, which he did. But it just doesn't matter. Because you have these cultural institutions that just come over the top of study after study after study, the data that everybody pretends to be so concerned about, and continue to prosecute the white supremacy, systemic racism narrative to the point of, you know, Cori Bush's $14 trillion reparations plan.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, how do we, it's almost like, it's sort of a counterintuitive thing to say, but it's like almost like, how do we get beyond the data?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the key issues is people don't always really understand the data. Yeah. So I think a lot of this issue around, narratives around systemic racism, white supremacy, and that kind of thing, you know, really have a inflated sense of what is going on. So, people at Skeptic Magazine have shown, for instance, if you ask people, you know, how many unarmed black men have been shot by, you know, police officers, you know, in the last year, say, you get these like wild, you know, some people think it's like 10,000 or more unarmed black men have been shot by, you know, police in the United States in any given year. And I could tell you, I looked this morning because, you know, I tried to keep an eye on it. Yeah, the Washington Post keeps a database where they follow these things. And I can tell you right now in 2023, so far, the year's not over, but, you know, the number of unarmed black men that have been shot by police in the United States in 2023 so far is 4 so far, you know. Now, we might say, well, you know, any number is too many. You know, the correct answer should be 0, you know. But, you know, I think people have to understand it's 4, not like 10,000, you know what I mean? So, and the other things you have to look at is people kind of think, well, you know, 4 black men, you know, being unarmed black men being shot, but no unarmed white men still indicates that there's something going on. But, you know, at the same time, what happens is, you know, white men are, unarmed white men are being shot by police. It just doesn't get as much news media coverage.
Well, there we go. The media.
Yeah, and that results in this sort of perception that, you know, police are targeting black men and are not targeting white men. So, you know, it is an important issue. It is a nuanced and complicated issue. But, you know, when the news media are only sort of telling one side of the story, that creates this distortion effect that, you know, can do a lot more harm than good when people don't have all the facts in front of them.
Well, exactly. I mean, I could name half a dozen, maybe more, black individuals who were killed by police, some illegitimately, like Walter Scott or George Floyd, and some legitimately because they were armed, because they were putting an officer's life in danger, somebody else's life in danger. But I can name the names because we spend so much time covering all of the angles of those cases. I can't name one white person that was shot and killed by police that even if it was ruled an improper shooting. And that speaks to where the emphasis is, what dominates. And so, of course, if you're only talking about white cops shooting black men mainly, then you're going to have a completely distorted view of what's going on if you don't step back and think about it or read about it and try and actually develop a nuanced understanding of what's happening and what's not happening.
Yeah. And I think what people sometimes will say is, you know, even if, you know, police shootings of unarmed individuals are rare and, you know, more white men are shot than than black men. And of course, the other thing is nobody mentions is Asian men. So Asian men are almost never shot, I believe. They're shot much less than white men are. But people kind of ignore that data point. But
well, right.
You know, even if white men are shot more than are black men overall, well, proportionally, people point out, you know, black men are proportionally shot more often. So, you know, black individuals make up 13% of American citizens, you know, but may make up somewhere around one third of unarmed, you know, shootings by police. But then if you look at the data on, and this is kind of the uncomfortable part, I mean, I think this is what a lot of people on the political left, you know, don't really want to address, is if you look at perpetrators of violent crime, you know, you see the same breakdown, you know, that, you know, young black men about, you know, represent one third or so of perpetrators of violent crime. So it works out to be a very mirror of the data. Now, if there was systemic racism, what you'd expect to see is that, you know, black Americans were, you know, about the same as everybody else in terms of perpetrating violent crime. You know, they were not overrepresented as perpetrators, but they were overrepresented as victims of shooting. When you look at the numbers and you see that the proportion of perpetrators and proportion of victims of police shootings are the same, it argues it's not systemic racism. It's simply contact. You know, it's coming into contact with police that's driving these numbers. Same reason that, you know, most people who are shot by police are men. You know, there are very, very few women. There are some, but there are very, very few women who are shot by police. But we don't say that policing is sexist against men, right? You know, we just understand
yeah,
that men
right, commit, exactly.
You know, a lot more crimes, you know.
Right.
And it's important to point out that, you know, in all these cases, we're talking about extreme individuals. You know, we're talking about perpetrators of violent crime. We're not talking about the entire, you know, black community, Latino community, white community, anybody else. Most people are, you know, law-abiding citizens. So we're not, you know, extending this to entire populations of human beings. You know, but we do have to understand these numbers, because if we have a misinterpretation of what's going on in this data, we're going to start proposing solutions that'll make things worse. And that's where you get into the defund the police, the anti-carceral, you know, kind of, you know, where people want to get rid of prisons and jails and that kind of thing. And I remember that being proposed in 2020, you know, and it was really was literally, you know, defund or abolish the police back then. And thinking, I, you know, I thought I woke up in a whole other planet. Like, you know, I know, I mean, and criminologists know that the reason why societies today are as peaceful as they are is because of essentially the invention of modern policing in the 19th century. And you take that away and you end up with chaos, you know, and that's exactly what has happened in a lot of American cities over the last few years, that as we've delegitimized policing, that has resulted in a you know, fairly substantial increase in violent crime that now has become a real big problem, especially for exactly the poor communities that, you know, progressives ostensibly are trying to help.
Right. But of course, yeah. You're up against the those in the media and the race hustlers that the media likes to elevate that sport the dark triad personality traits. Since you're a psych professor, you know this. I mean, these are people that know what you're saying is true, and they don't care because that's not their agenda.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of, you know, what has emerged over the last 10 years, again, sort of looking back to 2014 and sort of like the Great Awakening or whatever you want to call this thing, you know, I think a lot of these narratives are about what, you know, makes, you know, well-educated, mostly white people happy, you know, you know, feel good about themselves. It's really not a movement that is well-designed to help poor people, you know. And I think that's what you see when people talk about, you know, Black Lives Matter or something of that sort, that there seems to be this, you know, massive concern about policing. And like I said, I mean, you know, the number of people that are shot by police in any given year, whether it's legitimate or not legitimate, you know, is dwarfed by the number of homicide, you know, victims. And so there is this question, if, you know, I certainly agree, Black Lives Matter, you know, but why don't the lives of Black homicide victims matter, you know, when we're talking about this stuff? And it seems like, you know, people are not concerned about that issue. You know, and if you ask a lot of these communities, whether they're Black or white, you know, or Latino, the poor communities that are struck by crime, they want more police, you know,
right.
They want police to
They're only interested in those murders, like at the network affiliate level, for their murder du jour, for the grieving relative. That's what they're interested in for, as for exploitive purposes, which is part of the sickness as well. He is Chris Ferguson. He's professor of psychology at Stetson University in Florida, author of Catastrophe, The Psychology of Why Good People Make Bad Situations Worse. Professor Ferguson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was great to be on today. Thank you very much.
And you joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560 The Answer.
Cause they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy's off, so it's just me. And everything new, or everything old is new again at Northwestern University. As I've recounted before, back when I was on campus, I was easily the most hated person on campus because not only was I one of the co-founders of the weekly independent newspaper, the alternative to the Daily Northwestern, where all the Medill grads congregated, called the Northwestern Chronicle, by the way. I also ran a conservative speakers bureau called the Conservative Council. And I had run-ins with ASG, Associated Student Government, all of these centralized planners in training over at Northwestern, you know, the best and the brightest. And they actually tried to remove me as the president of this student group that brought conservative speakers to campus. I won't get into all the gory details of it, but they brought me before the ASG Tribunal Star Chamber, probably a more accurate description, and try and move like articles of impeachment to have me removed as the head of the student group. And you know, I was able to F. Lee Bailey my way out of it. But that's the same thing going on many, many moons later after I was there. It happened earlier this month. James Lindsay, you know, conservative speaker, public discourse. We've played clips from him before when he was part of a panel at the EU talking about essentially the identitarian ideology of our day, the left's identitarianism. And that was the topic of his speech at Northwestern, the dangers of identity politics and intersectionality. Unlike back in my day, apparently the administration allowed James Lindsay to come, and there wasn't much that Associated Student Government could do about it. Back when I was there, there were a lot of speakers that, I mean, so this has been going on for a long time, and actually more aggressively back in time in some respects. The administration, when I was there, I mean, they would sponsor all the leftist speakers. Patricia Ireland, who was the head of National Organization for Women at the time, Sister Solja, who was sort of the flash in the pan Black Lives Matter activist of her day, Ice-T, and on and on and on. Every Angela Davis, every communist under the sun. And there was efforts to prevent speakers from coming to campus. That didn't happen here. Lindsay was able to come and speak. But after the fact, the college Republicans were brought up on charges, effectively, because of a flyer that was posted around campus publicizing the event. And the flyer had an image associated with the speech title, The Dangers of Identity, Politics, and Intersectionality, of sunglasses with a rainbow flag and a skull and crossbones in the, on the glasses, and the shades themselves. And of course, what does that convey? Identitarian politics is poison, as I've said often on this show. It's intellectual poison. But that wasn't the interpretation of the luminaries on the Associated Student Government. They call that a threat to the LGBT community. By the way, the designer of that logo, that image on the flyer, gay. Doesn't matter. They called it offensive, And one of the individuals on the student government, their names are not important. They'll be in some government bureaucracy someday, and they won't be important then either. I said, there is a side of injustice and one of justice. ASG does not want to be on the side of injustice. So they froze the funds of the College Republicans, which really aren't theirs to freeze, really, without getting into the nuances of student government, student activities fees. Anyway, what are the College Republicans going to do about it? Augustin Baer is the acting president of Northwestern University's College Republicans, and he joins us now. Augustin, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, Dan. And to answer your question, what are College Republicans going to do about it? I think it's more what we did. And what we did was we said the truth. We stood up for what we believe in. We spoke with different media outlets. We tried to, you know, patiently and responsibly speak with university officials and even with ASG executives. And even though originally they didn't invite us in for any of their deliberations when they passed this emergency legislation, oh, so important, to cut our funding. No, they didn't call us in. They didn't even notify us afterwards. Eventually, the university was feeling a little bit uncomfortable, I assume, because they had some of their executives sit down and talk with us. And when I sat down with them, I had to apologize for the flyer, which, by the way, was being put out by YAF, which is an independent organization from College Republicans, when
Young America's, you know,
the first BAS came out. Exactly. Like, we have a chapter at Northwestern. It's a new thing. Honestly, there's a lot of overlap between the two groups, but they were putting out first, and I was like, okay, you know, we're also co-hosting. You should put at least our logo on it, too.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, eventually, right.
By the way, just as a quick aside, Young America's Foundation is now headed by former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, as we've had on this show. But anyway, so just go ahead. It's just a conservative speakers bureau that helps student groups around the country. Conservative student groups bring conservative speakers to campus. But sorry, go ahead, Augustin.
Yeah, exactly. So I was able to sit down and talk with them and learn about their procedures. You know, the letter of the law is important. And what we figured out was, A, that they understood they had messed up in not bringing us in, and B, that their law was all bark and no bite, because it was pending an investigation by the university into those flyers, and the university didn't believe those flyers merited an investigation. You know, there was nothing wrong with them, and even if some people got offended, well, subjective belief of harassment does not constitute so, according to the, you know, Northwestern's own policies and guidelines on it. So what I just received last night was confirmation from ASC that there is no investigation, and that, you know, per the legislation's parameters, the freeze on College Republicans' funding is now void.
Oh, very good. All right. Now, maybe you should put that logo in question. As a representing Associated Student Government, maybe that could be their new logo, because they're intellectual poison as well. But I mean, that the whole thing, it's so perfect, because essentially, just going back to my case and without the details, essentially there was a double jeopardy. They attempted to violate sort of, you know, our societal norms and criminal legal norms of double jeopardy when they tried to depose me as the head of this conservative speakers bureau I ran. And so it sort of went the same way. And so here we have them, you know, unilaterally freezing a funding, a power they don't have, and they don't engage the party that whose funding they're freezing. I mean, these people are probably going to be, you know, members of the Illinois General Assembly before too long upon graduation.
Quite possible. But, you know, one of the factors that gives me a little bit of relief is to see at least that there are, you know, even if there's a lot of them and their ideas are crazy, they're still pretty incompetent. So that's nice.
That's the good news. So what is, you know, just generally speaking, and maybe this is an indication of it, what is campus culture like at Northwestern these days?
Well, for most people, they're rather indifferent. They just go with the flow, you know. Human beings are pack animals. Like, we like moving in groups. We're social. It makes sense. Sometimes it's hard, I think, especially when your thoughts might end up being inconvenient. right? But there are some activists, you know, some lower on the rungs of the ladder who believe that they society owes them, whether because they're, you know, some sort of ethnic or cultural or religious or, honestly, nowadays, some sort of sexual or gender or something minority. And then there are some who think that they are the future elites, that they are the, you know, the figures that will lead our country and the world into their beautiful multiculturalism.
You know, what's fun about that? If I could just stop you there. You know what's fun about that? So they're at this elite, quote-unquote, elite university. And they simultaneously consider themselves victims and elites that are part of the new vanguard class. It's amazing the split mind that they are able to hold these contradictory ideas in their minds at the same time, which is, by the way, a definition of either genius or psychopathy. You can determine which.
Well, I will say there are some students who are there on scholarship, people who have worked really hard and who are victims of circumstances, right? Who have difficult family backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds, you know, just less resources in their lives, who have, you know, made their way up through their own efforts and through, you know, intelligence and hard work, people who I very much admire. And the university focuses much less on these people than those who complain about being misgendered, right? So that's sort of the point that we've reached. It used to be, I don't know, back in the day, 50 years ago, the Democrats cared about, like, the little guy, you know, the hard worker, blue collar, you know, the black guy in the South who could get lynched if he looked at a white woman sideways. Like, it used to be about actual problems, actual suffering from actual people, and now it's about pretended problems, about, you know, pretended suffering over pretended identities.
Mm-hmm. What are you studying at Northwestern? Mm-hmm. What's your story? What year are you? What are you studying?
I'm a junior. I'm studying my major's in economics, and I'm minoring in business and French.
Well, okay, very good. And what are you going to do upon graduation?
I'm going to work. Actually work for a corporation that provides services for other people.
Okay. That's you know, that's just crazy enough to potentially benefit you.
I would like to have a family one day and keep them safe from all this craziness.
And how are you, especially now with this profile, you and other college Republicans, how are you being received on campus as you go from, you know, class to activities and so forth?
Overall, not too much interaction in person. You know, one of the things I've noticed with people who try to be bullies is they also tend to sometimes be cowards. Mm-hmm. But online, I'm not really on social media, which I think is a good thing. But I heard from other people they were doing, like, false quotes trying to paint me as a racist or anti-Semitic or, you know, really ugly stuff like that. I'm toning it down. But honestly, I just don't care. I'm here to say the truth, and I'm here to help other people. And it's because I care about, you know, these people who are confused that, you know, I'm going to keep on working with college Republicans to bring in other speakers to remind them of what reality is, you know, give them their check.
Very good. He is Augustin Bear, gives some hope for the future, even for Northwestern graduates. Hopefully you'll maybe recast the reputation of the university better than I have. Augustin Bear, acting president of Northwestern University College Republicans. Augustin, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck at school. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Now, from the Signature Bank Studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Touch of your hand makes my pulse react. That it's only the thrill of boy meeting girl, opposites attract. It's physical, only logical. You must try to ignore that it means more.
Remembering the late, great Tina Turner and her soulful, sultry stylings, particularly as a 80s music aficionado. She gave us a lot of great music in the 80s. Passed away, as I'm sure you've heard by now, at the age of 83 yesterday. Clay Travis posted this mashup video that someone did, and it's excellent. This is under the topic of no COVID amnesty. Recurring segment. We have theme music in development. That's how recurring it's going to be. And cut it up in a few parts, but just again to remind people of the monomaniacal repetition of slogans developed in some lab at the CDC, I suspect, or at the DNC. What's the difference? The repetition, the groupthink, the unwillingness to answer questions, consider alternative views, just do what you're told and repeat what we say, Simon Says style. No one is safe until everyone's safe. No one is safe until everyone's safe. No one is safe until everyone's safe. No one is safe until everyone's safe.
We want to make sure that people can discern the truth from the misinformation. And we want to make sure that everyone understands that no one's safe till everyone's safe.
No one is 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 safe.
Nobody's safe.
No one is safe.
Nobody is safe.
This is a post-9/11 axiom. Safer, but not yet safe.
No one is safe. No one is safe. No one is safe. No one is safe from COVID-19 until everyone is safe.
If the whole world isn't safe, none of us are safe.
No one is safe.
No one is safe.
Nobody is safe
until we're all safe.
Health experts have been saying nobody is safe.
Nobody is safe until everybody is safe.
Nobody is safe.
Science is clear.
None of us are safe.
There is no safety.
No one is safe.
No one is safe.
No one is safe.
No one is safe until everyone is safe.
No one's safe.
Nobody is safe.
Nobody's safe.
No one's safe.
We'll never be safe
until we're all safe.
We are never going to be safe.
Pick a network. Pick an academic institution. Pick a public health agency. Spin the wheel. You have to see the video. I'm not going to run through every name that's included in there, but they are legion. You may be surprised, some of them. No one is safe until everyone's safe. No one is safe until everyone's safe. That's 1.0. Do you remember 2.0? Say it with me. No one is safe until everyone is safe by getting vaxxed. No one is safe until everyone is safe by getting vaxxed. No one is safe until everyone is safe by getting vaxxed.
99.5% of people are safe and will survive COVID-19.
The only positive thing out of this is we should be able to manufacture a lot of vaccines. And
nobody will be safe if not everybody is vaccinated.
You don't have a choice.
As long as not everybody is vaccinated, nobody will be safe.
Normalcy only returns when we've largely vaccinated the entire global population. So
get the f***ing vaccine.
You need to get vaccinated. And if you don't, you are going to die.
I know you're vaccinated. You're the smart ones, but you know there's people out there who aren't listening to God and what God wants. You know who they are.
The unvaccinated people.
My message to unvaccinated Americans is this.
If you are the unvaccinated, you are the problem.
You're the problem.
Condemn them, shame them, blame them.
The only people that you can blame are the unvaccinated.
Frankly, we can't trust the unvaccinated.
They should not be part of polite society.
The lunatics who won't take COVID vaccines walking around lawfully unvaccinated. That's psychotic.
If you're willing to walk among us unvaccinated, you are an enemy.
You have no right not to be vaccinated.
You don't have the right to contaminate someone.
You can't go around pointing a gun in somebody's face, which is what it is when people are unvaccinated.
They are all idiots. And losers.
Keith this Olbermann. Is a real movement in this country against the unvaccinated.
Jennifer Aniston is cutting non-vaccinated people out of her life.
The unrepentant, unvaccinated.
They should be removed from the hospital.
Those who refuse to be vaccinated should be denied health care.
Vaccinated person having a heart attack? Yes, come right on in. We'll take care of you.
Jimmy
unvaccinated Kimmel. Guy, rest in peace, Wheezy. You're...
Some doctors are saying they'll refuse treatment for people who choose not to get the shot.
Why are hospital and ICU resources going to them?
Morons who will not get the shot.
The unvaccinated clowns.
Idiots who think that they can do their own research.
Don't do any of your own research.
Doing your own research is associated with conspiracy theory circles.
This go-it-alone approach, doing your own research,
it can have serious consequences.
You should get prison time for even questioning the vaccines.
Prison time. from Jim Cramer over at the Investotainment Networks to the late night talk shows to all the networks. Mm-hmm. By the way, included in that, Ben Shapiro's tweet from December of 2020. In other words, get the vaccine, dopes. Ben Shapiro. Yeah. I didn't get the vaccine. Am I dead? Am I still here? Is this thing on? God, is that you? So you got part one, part two. No one is safe until everyone's safe. No one is safe until everyone is safe by getting vaxxed. You remember part three. The vax stops transmission. The vaccine stops transmission. You won't get it or give it. You won't get it or give it. You won't get it or give it. You won't get it or give it.
The virus stops with every vaccinated person.
Do it so you stop spreading this terrible disease.
And that vaccine, a key goal is to stop the transmission so that you get almost no infection going on whatsoever.
Expectation for vaccines is not to get infected.
A vaccinated person gets exposed to the virus does not infect them.
When the virus gets to you, you stop it.
You're not going to catch it, you're not going to get sick, you're not going to transmit it.
The vaccine is absolutely bulletproof.
Vaccines block you from getting and giving the virus.
100% effective at preventing COVID.
A vaccine prevents you from getting infected.
It is to keep you from getting it and then spreading it.
We have the ability to stop COVID in its tracks.
You're not going to get COVID if you have these vaccinations.
Biden tests positive for COVID-19.
When people are vaccinated, they can feel safe that they are not going to get infected.
Dr. Fauci tests positive for COVID-19.
Vaccinated people do not carry the virus, don't get sick.
CDC director tests positive for COVID-19.
Get your vaccine.
Colbert.
Pfizer CEO tests positive for COVID. Pfizer CEO tests positive for COVID again. CDC director tests positive for COVID again. Fauci tests positive for COVID again. Joe Biden tests positive for COVID again.
Cases up 258%. The majority of these cases are among the vaccinated.
And this area is the most vaccinated part of Massachusetts.
Enjoying the trip down memory lane? The last part, so we have no one is safe until everyone is safe. No one is safe until everyone is safe by getting vaxxed. The vax stops transmission. You won't get it or give it. Won't get it or give it. Won't get it or give it. And when you didn't get it, pandemic of the unvaccinated. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. It's a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
The pandemic of the unvaccinated.
The fact is, this is the pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Experts call it
a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Still a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
The disease of the unvaccinated.
It is the unvaccinated who are the problem.
Period. End of story.
The unvaccinated also put our economy at risk.
This is a tyranny of the unvaccinated right now.
The unvaccinated, not the vaccinated, the unvaccinated. That's the problem.
That's the pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Pandemic of the unvaccinated.
All this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
The only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated.
Pandemic because of the unvaccinated.
When you get the vaccine, you will not die.
That's right. That's right.
This is a simple, basic proposition. If you're vaccinated, you're not going to die.
If you're vaccinated, you don't have a risk. It's as simple as black and white.
You are not going to die if you are vaccinated. That's
and
it.
Then,
full stop.
You're unvaccinated, you're at risk. You're vaccinated, you're safe.
A majority of Americans dying from coronavirus are vaccinated. COVID-19 isn't a pandemic of the unvaccinated anymore.
We didn't really understand the fatality rate. You know, we didn't understand that it's a fairly low fatality rate and that it's a disease mainly of the elderly, kind of like flu is, although a bit different.
Bill Gates at the end there. What we didn't understand, what he didn't understand. And all of his fellow members of the intelligentsia. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Before we get to calls, I do want to deliver some good news. Thanks to Alex Berenson, who is actually one of the members of the intelligentsia, did unbelievably good reporting throughout the pandemic. One of the heroes here with Jeffrey Tucker at the Brownstone Institute and, of course, epidemiologists, infectious disease experts like Ioannidis at Stanford and Kulldorff at Harvard and Bhattacharya at Stanford. Yulia Hicks. Remember her? We talked about her story. She was the North Carolina girl, 14 years old, who was denied a life-saving kidney transplant because she was unvaccinated. At Duke. Transplant surgeons at Duke told her parents that Yulia could not stay on the transplant list if she did not have a COVID shot, even though she had already had COVID. And she's 14 years old. What did Bill Gates just say? We didn't understand. Duke University doctors didn't understand either and put this little girl's life in jeopardy. We talked a lot about people on the transplant list. You either get the vax or see you later. First, do no harm. Well, the good news is that her story led to a wave of publicity. More than 30 potential donors stepped forward to offer themselves, to offer a kidney to this little girl. So there's some great Americans out there, isn't there? Now another North Carolina has stepped up, and Yulia will receive a new kidney from a live donor today, I guess, because Berenson wrote this yesterday. Just a little background on Yulia. She came from Ukraine to the U.S. in December of 18, was given up by her first two adoptive families before the Hickses adopted her in 21. She suffers from senior Loken syndrome, which is a genetic condition that damages her kidneys and eyes. Her mom, Christine, said, "Yulia is the most easygoing child I have ever met. We're looking at 1 week of hospitalization, and she plans to read, write, and play cards. Her birthday, which is in June, the only thing she asks is to have an early birthday party because she knows she's going to face months of quarantine after the transplant as her body accepts the new kidney." They don't know who the donor is yet, but they hope to meet, the donor's anonymous, but they hope to meet him or her in the years to come to thank them. Meanwhile, in terms of reforms, the North Carolina legislature is considering Yulia's law. Something that you may want to call North Carolina legislators, even from Illinois, to encourage, which would bar transplant discrimination on the basis of COVID vaccination status. It's passed the North Carolina House and passed a first reading in the Senate. Of course, you have a dipstick Dem governor named Roy Cooper that it's going to have to get beyond or be get by or have, if he vetoes it, the North Carolina legislature override his veto. But at least you're seeing some legislators in some states legislate in the direction of the data and the science. Nice to have a positive story, though. Nice that Yulia survived the medical establishment in this country. Steve in Downers Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, thanks for taking my call. I have a public health background. I'm an MPH, Master's Degree Public Health. Graduated a number of years ago from St. Louis University School of Public Health, probably the best-known Jesuit School of Public Health in the United States. Just a couple of comments. In your litany of idiots, please don't forget Governor Cuomo.
Oh, I won't.
New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, please don't. Who took all of these COVID-positive older adults and killed them by putting them all back in the nursing home, exactly where you don't want them to go. And he's just kind of faded into, regrettably, obscurity without any legal consequences. Additionally, I was hospitalized for COVID myself. You're one of our better-known, prestigious suburban hospitals, and I was in there for a week on a COVID unit, and the medical staff at that hospital wouldn't even come into my room to examine me. They yelled at me from the corridor and sent all the lackeys, the nursing assistants, in. But the doctors themselves were so frightened of it, they wouldn't even come in and examine me. So there are a lot of people out there that certainly are, and you know this, pretty good at talking the talk, but certainly don't walk the walk. So keep on preaching about COVID, Dan. That's a great message. Thanks much. Have a great day and a great Memorial Day weekend. Let's honor our vets. Thanks.
You too. Thanks for the call, Steve. Appreciate the call. John in Florence, Wisconsin.
Well, I just wanted to call and say thanks for putting that montage together. When Rush used to do it back in the day, God rest his soul, I was always amazed at how all these educated idiots would have the same lines. So they must be getting briefed from somebody.
And or sharing a brain.
It just,
Yeah.
I swear to God. When it comes to, the censorship and keeping the fight up against COVID, it's still going on with what Dr. John Campbell is going through, getting censored, just playing clips of British MPs talking about what a nightmare it was over there, censoring him for 3 weeks, bringing it back, censoring him again. This is an ongoing fight with stuff, not just for our health, but for the freedoms going forward that we're going to have after the 2024 election and the next big crisis.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it. Tim and Zion.
Hey, how's it going? I was sick probably with COVID like 3 times. Once before they came out with the vaccine and twice after. I was never hospitalized, and I never got the vaccine. I'm unvaccinated, and I feel fine. You know, I've been around people who got it. Some of my relatives, they got vaccinated, and they still got COVID. And also, the government was really never able to enforce it. What happened was, if you remember, most of these businesses started coming out and enforcing it by threatening people they would lose their places of employment by not getting the vaccine, which basically happened at my job. So, but it's like they were wiser than the people and forcing the people to inject something into their bodies that they really didn't want, you know?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Tim. Appreciate it. Rick, Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I mentioned this to Dennis Prager, and COVID proved it, and you backed it up with your little montage, which I really like. But the more college-educated people a society has, the weaker, more feeble, and easily brainwashed that society becomes. And he agreed with that, and you just have to look at what happened with COVID, and that basically proves it.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Tina, Joliet.
Hi, good morning. Hey, I just wanted to say that the stupidity is still running rampant within our medical institutions. I just had a telehealth online doctor appointment with my dermatologist. This is the second time now, and he wears masks during our online telehealth.
Wears a mask during your online telehealth. Yeah, well, that's why there's no COVID amnesty here at Morning Answer. Chicago's Morning Answer, Dan and Amy.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.